Hello and welcome to another episode of Rational Actors on Blogging Heads. I'm Kevin Glass, Managing Editor at Town Hall, and today I'm joined by...
Lucy Staggerwald.
Thanks for being with us, Lucy. Well, me, the royal we. Now, I wanted to talk to you about a piece that you wrote for Vice News recently. You write their bad cop blotter, and you dedicated your last one to the case of Shanine Allen, who was arrested on criminal charges in New Jersey relating to her gun that she owned legally in Pennsylvania. Could you give me kind of a little more in-depth on what happened there, why she was arrested, and why we should think that this is an injustice?
Well, Shanine Allen was arrested last October, and she's a resident of Philadelphia. She was in New Jersey, and she got pulled over for a minor traffic violation, an unsafe lane turn or something. You know, she says she was a little tired, so she wasn't driving as well as she might have been. And in the course of the cop chatting about the situation, Shanine Allen mentioned that she had a concealed handgun. Not on her, I believe it was just in her car, though I suppose I'd have to check on that. And, you know, cops get, a lot of people that I read tend to argue she should have just said nothing, you know, and gone on her way, which might be true, but I assume she was trying to be safe because cops tend to get jumpy when people have guns, legal or not. So Shanine Allen turned over, you know, her concealed carry permit. She also had some hollow point bullets. And in New Jersey, this means she was unlawfully in possession of a handgun and unlawfully in possession of this particular ammunition, because once she crossed into New Jersey with that handgun, the legality of it in her home state was basically irrelevant, because New Jersey doesn't acknowledge the other states' gun laws. So she made a big mistake, and now she may pay for that with 3 years in prison, which sounds absurd to a lot of people, at least people, you know, who are correct.
Yeah, so to me it seems like, to a certain extent, varying gun laws by varying states make sense, right? Gun laws in Wyoming should probably be different than gun laws in the District of Columbia, which is a very dense city of 600,000 people, and, you know, no big game hunting or what have you. So it seems like if we were to try and find a solution for this, I mean, does it matter that, you know, the law in New Jersey is different than Pennsylvania? Shouldn't New Jersey's law, shouldn't this be something that is, you know, the right thing to do? Like, you know, for example, you take Chicago, which is a city with a lot of gun violence problems, and it's not on the border, but close to the border with Wisconsin, where they definitely have different laws on guns than in Illinois. Doesn't it make sense that Chicago and their, you know, police units, their police force, should be more concerned about people owning illegal weapons, and certainly weapons that are illegal or are legal in different states, and they should be illegal in Chicago? Doesn't it make sense, I guess, for these laws to be adjudicated this way? And what would it mean if they weren't? I mean, would there be a kind of race to the bottom where guns that are legal in other states are just registered in other states, and, you know, people own them legally in different states but can carry them wherever they want?
I suppose that sounds feasible. I mean, there's a million ways to refute that. I understand, like, the Federalists' impulse to say, you know, well, New Jersey gets to decide, and Pennsylvania gets to decide, and Texas gets to decide on various things. You know, we do have the Second Amendment, of course, and arguably, once, you know, it was ruled officially that all of these amendments apply to the states as well as the federal government. Well, I mean, shouldn't that have been the Second Amendment as well? You know, I know it hasn't been challenged quite in this way, but the Second Amendment should apply to the states. But even without going that far, I think part of this, the ridiculousness of this case is just the fact that there is no, there's no fail-safe emergency button to push for sanity. And this is the problem with law. You know, it's, there's this woman, she has two kids. I haven't heard any evidence to suggest she had any dire motivation beside, you know, nothing beyond didn't know the law as well as she should have for her own protection. Part of this is the problem with prosecutors who, you know, the prosecutor in this case could have given Alan a sort of, I'm not sure what the equivalent would be in a gun case, but it basically says, oh, you know, we're going to give you the soft sort of, I'm blanking on the word now, but basically, you know, there's potential to give her at least, you know, a break on this, and the prosecutor decided not to do so. And this happened, New Jersey, there was a case of Brian Aitken, who a couple years ago was facing 7 years in prison in New Jersey for guns that he had legally purchased in Colorado, and he was in the process of moving from Colorado. His mother had called the cops because she thought he was oppressed, which basically you should never do at this point in our society. And this thing sort of snowballed, but it ended up, you know, a very similar situation where there were guns that had been legally acquired somewhere. And this man was facing 7 years in prison for doing nothing, you know. There's got to be some sanity here. And if nothing else, I would say that prosecutors should have more accountability and should be shamed and booted out of office for going after this kind of a case. But there are a lot of, I mean, there are a lot of elements and a lot of issues that come into play here.
Yeah, that's certainly a fair point that in terms of prosecutorial discretion, it should be heavily lenient in a case like this. And certainly if those prosecutors are accountable to the people, and I'm not sure what the law in New Jersey is, if they're appointed or if they're elected, that's a good point to bring up, that people need to know about these cases just to, at the very least, name and shame the law enforcement officers, both on the police force and in the attorney's offices, that they need to take it easy on people who clearly, you know, Shanine Allen clearly had no intent of committing a crime. It was a traffic stop. She basically pointed to the officer to where she was keeping the guns in her car. But I think I wanted to take a different look at this. And Radley Balko also wrote about this for the Washington Post, that there's a racial angle here, that Shanine Allen is a black woman who was arrested and is being charged, you know, like you said, to the fullest extent of the law on these charges. And you look at gun laws and gun enforcement laws more broadly, there is a racial element there that it's discriminatorily practiced. There's a more minorities are charged with gun crimes than and convicted and sentenced for gun crimes than white people. And I know that this is a fairly major point that libertarians like to make, that, you know, we talk about racial discrepancies in law enforcement and other areas. Why don't progressives also kind of display the same empathy for gun crimes when they are, you know, racially targeted like other crimes are?
That's the question, isn't it? I mean, I know that Balko was kind of shaming the various progressive outlets who hadn't yet talked about Alan. I'm trying to remember, Daily Kos, which, you know, is usually awful, had somebody written something that wasn't bad, that was actually sort of empathetic. Think Progress finally wrote about her, and their piece was, to me, was fascinatingly timid. And it, you know, it's sort of, you know, the to me it read like there was no giving her the benefit of the doubt, and it's, you know, it sort of mentioned, oh, mandatory minimums are an issue here, But there's also an issue in drug crimes. And then sort of at the end, it said, some people see this as a gun rights issue. And I was sort of like, well, yeah, I mean, it is. Of course it is. But also the fact that the piece was framing it like, was almost trying to distract and talk about the drug mandatory minimums instead. And there's been this amazing progress on a mandatory minimum sentencing reform with drug stuff on the federal level lately, and that's awesome. But I have been thinking in the last few months, and I'd like to write something big on this eventually, that the mandatory minimums with guns, which are at least as absurd, has not gotten reform or attention because it absolutely conflicts with the goal of gun control, the progressive goal of gun control. And the origins of gun control often have a fascinating racial element as well. You don't want your oppressed minority in the South to be able to defend itself, though sometimes they did. And law enforcement and, you know, the KKK is a threat. You know, you want to be armed, if at all possible. Right. And in California, you know, the first modern gun control, I guess there was the stuff against machine guns in the 20s and 30s and stuff. But the 60s, basically the Black Panthers started wandering around open carrying. And California was like, I don't think so. And this, you know, this was under Reagan as governor. And this was, as far as I've always heard, this was a very deliberate response to the Black Panthers making everybody nervous. So it's kind of fascinating to me that progressives are so timid and do not discuss the racial element of gun control ever, because it just doesn't go with their idea that the people that if there's gun control, you know, or Elliot Rogers and Eric Harris and, you know, the salon.com nightmare creature, instead of, you know, oh, that guy sold weed a couple of times with a gun strapped to his ankle, and that's an additional few decades in prison. I mean, they don't talk about it. At least not the progressive sites that I tend to look at. So it doesn't speak well of them, honestly. It really doesn't.
Right. So I want to probe you on the racial element here, right? We look at kind of crimes in all different kinds of areas, and the progressive response is we just need better policing, right? We need to let's say that our gun laws are generally just, they should apply broadly and they should apply in a race blind way, but the problem is that our law enforcement officers don't act in a race blind way, that they target minorities and they use these laws, and the answer to that is better training, better policing, etc. That's the same argument that drug prohibitionists would make about the drug war, right? Is that the drug laws are just, it's the enforcement that needs to be changed. And so what if, in the grand scheme of things, our law enforcement is just unjust in a racial way, that they often target minorities at a higher rate for crimes that should be crimes? You know, we can get into things that obviously anyone would say, you know, murder or theft or things like that, and say that our law enforcement agencies are enforcing these crimes probably at higher rates against minorities than they are against white people. And in general, sentencing, I think we can see across the board, is generally harsher for minorities than it is for white people. So what if, and this is, I think, the argument that progressives would make on gun control, the gun laws here are just. It's not about, the gun laws themselves are not, you know, repealing them or softening them are not going to solve the race problem. What's going to solve the race problem is better policing, better training, better law enforcement in general, and fixing the whole system. And it's not really about guns in general. Now, I know that might be hypocritical for a progressive to say, or especially a progressive who would say that the drug war is racist and there are racist elements to the drug war. But what if you did take kind of a consistent position across the board here and say that the problem isn't that the laws are unjust, it's that the practice is unjust.
Well, I would say that that's wrong, of course. And I also, I mean, that's part of the problem. I'm not saying, you know, the racial disparities shouldn't be pointed out, because they certainly should, because they're bad and because, you know, it helps to shame progressives. But the problem with the drug war at its heart is not simply, you know, it's racist. The problem with it is that it's morally unjust and practically a disaster. And even if it were, you know, egalitarian and applied, just, you know, the rich white guy and the poor black guy get the same exact sentencing every time, it would still be bad. and part of the argument that you just suggested, I mean, it just goes back to the horrible progressive fallacy of the fact that next time we're going to get the perfect guy as president, the perfect people in charge. We're going, you know, it's not a problem with power. It's a problem with the wrong people in power. And they refuse to acknowledge the greatest cliche and wisest cliche of them all, power, you know, corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. I believe that that's true. And progressives believe that next time, you know, the laws will be applied robotically and fairly. And that's what they believe. They talk about this with gun control a lot. You know, some horrible shooting happens. And, you know, all over Gawker or Jezebel or the other things that I addictively read and then despise. There's this talk of, you know, we need more gun control, this is all the fault of the right, etc. They don't talk about, okay, we're having gun control, what will that look like? How are we going to get the guns? What's the punishment for not, you know, obeying the rules? How many more people are you willing to see in prison to violate this law? Fundamentally, people are not robots, and they do not simply follow laws when you pass laws. And I think that at this point, we all need to accept that reality of human nature. But we don't, because we think that the law will fix this and the law will make it so. And it's just not how people work.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the, you know, power corrupts quote. My favorite is, if men were angels, there'd be no need for government. Which basically, you know, you talk, progressives say, if we had angels in government, our government would be just.
Precisely,
but
yes.
But the point is that men aren't angels. Mm-hmm. Humans aren't angels. Yeah, I wanted to kind of ask you about, and this kind of goes to the drug war thing we were talking about. There's a pseudo-uneasy alliance on the drug war between progressives and libertarians. And we've seen that a lot on the civil liberties side. Mm-hmm. You know, the ACLU is generally loved by libertarians, hated by conservatives, loved by progressives. But it kind of, and it works on the drug war. It kind of works on gun control. It's like I said, uneasy. And that's actually, I think gun control is one of the places, one of the largest places where I think the left libertarian and progressive alliance breaks down. But I wanted to talk about the militarization and now kind of monitoring of local police forces, mm-hmm. Which you've written about a little bit. And the kind of basically the smartphone revolution has allowed us, the surveilled citizenry, to record our law enforcement officers in their day-to-day jobs, and they hate this. Mm-hmm. The laws about recording officers at ordinary traffic stops, at, you know, protests, at things like this, that what you see time and time again is that law enforcement officers do not want to be recorded by people who are generally following the law and mm-hmm. just recording them in their duties. Do you see an alliance, like, does the Libertarian Progressive Alliance hold there? Because I have seen some progressives kind of defend the strict enforcement of laws by law enforcement officers, and kind of say that libertarians in general are a little paranoid on this case.
Well, we're always paranoid. I mean, that's our MO, right?
Is that a character trait of libertarians?
Allegedly. You know, I think with the cop thing, liberals, progressives, etc., have been pretty solid. Certainly the radical left, you know, the left anarchists, they, you know, have no love for cops at all, because they're, you know, the ones being beaten up by them at every protest. I mean, you get a type of liberal, and you get, certainly there's a conservatives, they have their own version of this, where they truly say that, you know, you have this obligation to follow the law as it exists. And I suppose one can argue that, but I don't, that doesn't end the debate on morality or practicality or anything like that. So, you know, if the weed smoker is breaking the law until the law changes, okay, so he broke the law, but does that mean he should have killed his dog and, you know, kicked his door in? I would say no. I think with cops in general, there is a bipartisan or tripartisan, to include libertarians. There is a pretty
cross-ideological. I like
that's easier. Yeah. There is a pretty solid backlash against them, which unfortunately I see will as them, you know, that turning them into even more the warriors with their back against the wall sort of nonsense. But conservatives are getting into it, especially the arguably, you know, paranoid, fringy right wingers. I don't know, my journalistic hero, which is awkward because I always make him awkward by saying this, Radley Balko, you know, has one of the, he gets a hell of a lot of credit for that, honestly. Certainly other people as well. The blogger, what's his name? Carlos Williams? Am I making that up? Or is that the poet? Photography is Not a Crime is a good blog that is devoted solely to instances where a cop has prevented someone from filming. You know, basically variations on that theme. I mean, YouTube, as you said, smartphones. Of course, I think the next question on that sort of thing is, are there consequences for bad cops, or are we simply now just aware that it's happening thanks to cameras? We know it when we wouldn't know it for sure, you know, a decade ago, but that doesn't end the problem. It just makes it, you know, more depressingly clear.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think it might be the case, though, that the knowledge that they're being recorded or might be being recorded moves us slightly towards a better world, right? That if a cop in an ordinary traffic stop, if a cop who would in the past kind of be one of those hard asses who's a jerk for no reason and you're a perfectly law-abiding citizen, might be less so if he thinks he's being recorded, even the threat of being recorded.
It has helped, not just cell phones, even, you know, body cameras on cops. A week or two ago, I had a little blurb about a woman who had charges of assault. I don't know, it was assault on a cop, maybe battery, resisting arrest. And they finally looked at his body camera footage, and they immediately dropped the charges against the woman because they were total bunk. On the other hand, honestly, the Kelly Thomas case gives me a really solid dose of cynicism about holding cops accountable.
What is the Kelly Thomas case? I don't think I've read about that.
That was a homeless man in Fullerton, California, who suffered from schizophrenia, was beaten by police 3 years ago in Fullerton. I don't remember how many were on the scene. I think five of them. You know, he was this mentally ill guy. He was known to the community. There is this 30-minute surveillance video, plus there's audio from the cops recording. Basically them beating him for half an hour, and it's incredibly chilling. One cop actually went up on trial for second degree murder, another for involuntary manslaughter, and they all and excessive force as well. And they all got off on all charges. And a third cop, the DA, decided not to pursue involuntary manslaughter charges. And the simple fact that it got as far as a trial is unfortunately a victory for accountability, because honestly, before the Fullerton community started saying, hey, we don't care that this was a mentally ill guy, we actually would like some accountability here, without them, it never would have gone to trial. And it got to trial, and that is a victory, but there was no accountability. And there was footage of that. I mean, there was surveillance footage and there was audio. There was enough that you would think that something would have been done. That case has been upsetting me for several years now. I know a lot of male journalists who it made cry. So,
yeah, and I saw, this is way more minor, but there was a viral video, that I saw. I think it was posted at Rare, which is another site you write for. They showed a traffic stop from the person being stopped's perspective. And this cop was being a jerk until he realized he was being filmed and his demeanor changed entirely.
Yeah.
And so that kind of reflects, I think, way back to the beginning of our discussion, that what conservatives say about guns, which is that if you think that everyone might be armed, you're not going to commit a crime. If cops think that everyone might be filming them, they might be on their best behavior.
A filmed society is a polite society.
That applies here. What?
A filmed society is a polite society, as it were.
Right. Something like that. So maybe that is something that would be effective in the long run. And I want to kind of point out some people on the conservative side who I think are coming around, which is very interesting to me because I grew up in the 90s with the kind of tough on crime Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a organization called the Right on Crime mm-hmm. Foundation, or just Right on Crime. That's an arm of the Texas Public Policy Foundation, which is a generally conservative organization. And they're doing great work down in Texas and across the country now. But it's this growing, I think, law enforcement abuse movement within the conservative movement. And it might only be a reflection of the Obama era in which, you know, conservatives think that they're being abused and they're being put upon and this government is out of control and they don't have any accountability. But I have hope for the long term that it is a more genuine sentiment that's growing in the conservative movement that actually, you know, there's a fairly large amount of abuse in law enforcement agencies, and that, you know, unaccountable bureaucrats are unaccountable bureaucrats, no matter if they're fighting crime or they're doing your taxes.
I both think that part of it is, you know, the usual partisanness, but I do think there is some genuine progress on this, which I think is so great. Rand Paul, you know, constantly disappoints libertarians. One day he's like, we get our hopes up, and the next day he breaks our hearts. But I honestly think the most credit that he deserves and most constant credit is his push on criminal justice reform. Before it was trendy, he pushed ahead of Holder and Obama back when they were twiddling their thumbs about it. And he, you know, a lot of the bills that he's been pushing or co-sponsoring have been bipartisan. And, you know, a libertarian joke usually can be, you know, bipartisan is, it's going to be the worst thing if both parties are agreeing on something. And for once, that's not the case. It does feel like there is real progress. And of course, it is after hundreds of thousands of, actually probably more than that, lives have been ruined by tough on crime. So, you know, it's about time. I'm not going to hug people after, you know, the drug war being probably the worst domestic policy that we've had in this century or in the last 100 years. My point, I'm getting away from it a bit, is that you mentioned the 90s. And in the 90s, you had the conservative backlash against federal law enforcement. And you had liberals, you know, being horrified by this. And you still see echoes of that. I was watching Rachel Maddow, you know, for some reason. And I remember her talking. It was, I think last year there was, I don't remember what the exact news hook was, but she was talking about the ATF. You know, for a while there was this trendy hand-wringing about how the ATF didn't even have a permanent head and their budget was so small, it was almost as small as it was when it started. Maddow was just so, you know, outraged that a federal agency hadn't grown exponentially. And she was talking about how in the 90s, someone from the NRA called the ATF jackbooted thugs, you know, either after Ruby Ridge or Waco. I never liked the NRA more when I heard that. But there's this hand-wringing about, like, you know, this suspicious Timothy McVeigh attitude. Oh, you don't like federal law enforcement? What are you, some kind of bunker-dwelling weirdo? So I honestly think that if the right starts to learn that local law enforcement or state is not, you know, necessarily your friend, and the left learns that federal law enforcement is not necessarily your friend, then you have your coming together. And I kind of hope that the camera thing and the just sudden realization that tough on crime was an abomination is helping. But I do always think there's some partisanship to it, because there always is, unfortunately.
Right. I mean, I remember in the Bush years, Marcos Melitzis, the founder of Daily Coast, wrote this article about how left libertarianism was the ascendant libertarianism, and that the alliance between progressives and libertarians was going to take over the country. And I'm pretty sure he disavows that at this point and detests libertarians with the vehemence that his colleagues at Salon do.
Salon.
Yeah, I do. I do think that I'm hopeful, I think I would say, as a libertarian-ish leaning Republican, that there is a more skeptical eye being opened on the right towards a lot of these issues, especially, you know, and I'm not sure which way the causation goes in Rand Paul's case, if people are drawn to Rand Paul because of his policies, or they're drawn to his policies because he's a charismatic individual in general, because I don't think that a lot of the things that he talks about, a lot of the bills that he co-sponsors with members of the Democratic Party, had a lot of cachet on the right really before he came into office, you know.
Hence the credit.
Libertarian-ish. Yeah. Libertarian-ish Republicans always had Ron Paul, but he was an easily marginalized member of a 435-person body.
Alas.
Rand Paul, as a senator, has a ton more power, a ton more cachet, and at least the perception that his views are slightly more moderate than his father's. So I think that he attracts a lot of people who are kind of, you talked about the paranoid right. I don't know if I would put it that way, but I think there are that skepticism of power, certainly of federalized power, but hopefully power, more hopefully power in general, would seep into the conservative movement a little more.
Yeah, here's hoping. Paranoid is never a slur coming from me, so I advocate rational paranoia. And even the irrational
not
kind
tinfoil
is
hats, but
yeah, it's not as bad as
not tinfoil hats, but just underground bunkers where you can live.
Hey, man, Alex Jones is, you know, full of lies and nonsense, but I still like him better than any president ever. I don't know.
Wow. That's quite the praise.
Not coming from me. It's not.
All right. Well, I think that's about all the time we have for today. Thanks a lot for joining me. And, I hope everyone goes and checks out some of Lucy's work at Vice and Rare, and I will see everyone next time on Blogging Heads.